Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Stephen, you know, obviously all four of us, you know, absolutely love the game. But football is still ultimately, and you know, Paul made his point there, football really is just moments in time. It's not full 90-minute memories. You know, with all the best will in the world, as passionate a Liverpool fan as you are, as passionate Everton fan as Paul is, you don't recall 90 minutes. You recall moments. And I think a football fan's sort of life is made up of just snapshots and moments in time. As I guess a player's, you know, as Paul's just said there, as a player's is as well. And it is the big moments, isn't it? It's big moments for players, as Paul's just said there, but it's the big moments for fans as well.
It is. It's, you know, snapshot images is what it comes down to. It's the flashpoint. You know, it's that moment of skill, or it's the error that someone makes, or the ball that the keeper drops, or it's the goal that wins the day. You know, and then these are the things that stand, you know, the test of time and live long in the memory. And, you know, whether that's your own team or, you know, someone else's team, there'll be something that just catches the eye and catches the imagination, and you can never dislodge it from the memory banks.
I guess, you know, same with you, Paul Mack, as well. You know, sort of the longer, I'm not sort of being derogatory about age here, but I guess the older you become, the more snapshots you collect, and they're almost like a mental scrapbook, but it's a priceless mental scrapbook, isn't it? I guess for players as well as for fans.
Yeah, I think as you progress through life's journey as well, those snapshots become more and more vivid, and maybe become more and more exaggerated. So the 40-yard shot becomes a 60-yard bend into the top corner of the net, you know. So I think that's definitely the case. And of course, as football fans, we grow up with memories, A, of snapshots of our own team, but B, we grow up with snapshots of other teams as well. I mean, that 1970 Brazil fourth goal in the World Cup final has lived for me forever. So as a football fan, obviously you appreciate your own team's efforts, but you also, if you are a football person, you should also recognise, you know, the skill that's gone into the efforts of other teams as well. And sometimes it's good, you know, I love watching programs like the Big Match Revisited on a Saturday morning on ITV4, because you have a memory of the game and you watch it again, and sometimes it bears no record. There's no similarity between what you thought that game was like and what actually turned out to be when we watch it a second time. It even that things that you forgot who took the corner, who took the free kick, whose mistake it was. So it's sometimes good to be to realise that, yes, we are all of these snapshots, but everyone's reality and perception of what those games were like is always going to be different.
It is, and I guess, again, that's part of the beauty of being a football fan, isn't it? What one person deems as an incredible moment, and probably one of the most memorable moments as a football fan, for somebody else might be just a very much, you know, an almost forgotten, obviously not key, you know, not winners in finals, but you'll remember things from games that people will have forgotten about almost instantaneously, because it is such a subjective area for a football fan. What one football fan loves, another one, you know, might not or might not appreciate.
I think also, it can also be associated with a certain time in your life as well, when your life might be going through particular changes, or you might be in a period of life where things are really going on the up, and the match kind of ties in with that as well. So sometimes I think there's a link between life's journey and the snapshot of the football game as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It does.
Can I just say on that point, the biggest thing about a footballer's career is confidence. If a player is playing with confidence, and you know, Everton are going to play Man City in the FA Cup this weekend, and there are players in both sides that have got to start with confidence. So Richarlison, for instance, you know, if he's playing with confidence, he's a real handful. Sterling for City and Mahrez, they're the same. If they start the game well, they'll do something special because they've got the ability to do something special, you know. I go back to that year when we got to the FA Cup final, and it was like an unbelievable year for me because the FA Cup, we played Norwich in the first round. I scored.
You played Palace in the first round. You
Crystal Palace. 4-0. Sorry, yeah, you, you're right. Crystal Palace would have scored.
Yeah, and Matt Maldini, I'd come back with Crystal Palace. And the next round you played John Bond's old team, Norwich City.
That's right. And I scored against Norwich as well.
Yeah.
Then we played Peterborough away. We won 1-0. Tommy Booth scored that one. So I missed out there. Then we played Everton in the quarterfinal and I scored at Goodison to make it 2-2. And then I scored when we beat them 3-1 at Main Road in the replay.
I don't think and Paul, don't forget you got Kevin Ratcliffe sent off as well.
No, Tommy Hutchinson did that. I don't think Kevin ever forgave Manchester City for that. But that, you know, you get to a situation where you're playing with so much confidence, you know, you feel as if you're in the zone. You know, people use this phrase, in the zone. But I actually, during that season, 1980-81, I felt as if I was in the zone every time I went on the football pitch because my confidence was sky high. The goal that I scored in the replay against Everton at Main Road, I sort of made a run past Dennis Stewart. We broke out from defence. Dennis played me a lovely weighted pass and I was through one-on-one with the keeper and I had a defender putting me under pressure. But I knew exactly what I was going to do with the ball because, you know, I was just full of confidence. If I'd have missed a couple of chances earlier on, you know, then the result might have been totally different. But it is amazing what the psychological factor of confidence plays in a good performance for any player and any team. Teams can be confident because they feel as if they're unbeatable. Like City at the moment, I'm sure, you know, even though they got beat by United the other night, you know, I think generally they would feel that they can go on the pitch and they can beat anybody that they play against, you know. So confidence is a massive factor in football, in sport generally, probably.
I want to come to the FA Cup semi-final and final, but just before we get to there, Paul, you know, you mentioned Malcolm Allison really, really, really briefly. And I guess the football fan in me wants to know a little bit about what he was like. You know, I'm interested in the arrival of Steve Daly at Manchester City. These are all things that I've sort of grown up with. Obviously, I was very young at the time, but Malcolm Allison is, you know, clearly a... you know, a name, a personality, a character. And it's, you know, to me, that's what attracts me to the game. I love the stories of the game. I love the characters of the game. And so just, I guess, just a little bit about what he was like.
Yeah, he was they used to call him Big Mal. You know, he was Kenny Clements, who I played with at City, always said that the only thing he learned off Malcolm Allison was how to light a cigar when it had gone out, like, you know. But that was him, you know. He had jewellery, he had a big cigar, he was a big guy, you know, but he was more than that because he was a student of the game and he knew how to improve individuals. To be honest with you, I mean, he used to get me out in the left-back position or as a left-winger and we'd go through routines where, you know, if I got to the byline, where would I play it to? You know, would you drop it into the far post? Would you smash it across the box? Would you beat the fullback and come inside? And so there were always options that that he would teach you how to improve at your individual job. I actually didn't learn how to defend in a back four until I went to Everton and I played under Howard Kendall and Colin Harvey, you know, and holding the line, knowing when to drop when the ball was under pressure in midfield. Well, it was always under pressure in midfield when I played for Everton because we had Peter Reid and Paul Bracewell who made sure the ball was under pressure and players then would have the head down so they weren't in a position that they could play a killing pass in behind the defence. So you could hold the line, you could hold further up the pitch and squeeze the play a little bit, which is now what Liverpool do. All over the pitch. So the front three are unbelievable at putting the ball under pressure. And of course, the higher you win possession of the ball up the pitch, the more likely you are to be able to convert that into a goal. So, you know, there are lots of things you learn to do as an individual and as a team. Big Mal was superb at improving individual players and getting them to understand their position.
Paul, can I just ask do you remember the 1981 documentary, the Granada TV filmed about City during that season? I watched it again last night. I've not seen it for about 30 years. It's fascinating from start to finish. And you mentioned about Big Mal. At his press conference there, he's there puffing away in a cigar and drinking a glass of wine with his feet up on the table. He's absolutely holding court to anyone who's prepared to listen to him. And there's loads of clips of him going around speaking to players one-on-one, giving them individual. And there's one great scene where Steve Daly has a go back at him, you know, because he I did all that for you, but what are you telling me to do this again for? But it's a fascinating documentary. And even the insight into John Bond, his interview being appointed as the manager as well. I don't know if you've seen it recently or whether you remember.
I remember it well because the cameras were in the dressing room all the time, you know. So, well, that was Mal. He had to be the centre of attraction as well. You know, the programme was about him, really, because a lot of that programme took place in the boardroom.
Yes, yes.
I remember from that particular show, Peter Swales, Mal had come in and he had got rid of experienced players like Dave Watson, you know, the old Dave Watson, who's unfortunately suffering from a little bit of dementia now, you know, so... but a great centre-half, played for England as well. He got rid of him because he favoured young athletic players. So we had Ray Ranson, Tommy Caton, who's no longer with us. We had Nicky Reid, who were all athletes, you know, but the people like Tony Henry that he brought in, Steve Daly, who he introduced to the club for big money then, Kevin Reeves he brought to City, young, fresh-faced. But he brought other players in that, because when he was first at Manchester City, he saw Tony Book play for Bath City and he signed him. Tony Book was a bricklayer during the day and played semi-pro at weekend. But I think he went on to play for Plymouth and then he signed for Manchester City. So and he became an absolute like a part of Manchester City's history, Tony Book, you know, raised off the ground on players' shoulders, holding the FA Cup at Wembley and everything, which unfortunately I never had the opportunity to do. But he made a minnow into a superstar. And I think he believed that he could do that, whatever era of football he was working in. When he came to City and he bought a couple of players, one was a lad called Paul Sugru, a lad called David Whiffle, that he saw playing non-league. And he thought that he was going to introduce them. Bobby Shinton came from Wrexham and, you know, and it just didn't happen for them. You know what I mean? And he wasn't able to sort of do what he'd done maybe 15, 20 years earlier. And I think that was his downfall. He believed in his own greatness, really, when at times, and there was probably nobody around that should, you know, that could have said to him, Mal, why don't you give that a second thought and why don't you change your mind about that? You know, he was quite stubborn, really. And, you know, in the end, it was his downfall because he carried on playing the way that he thought was right. Because this particular season, when we played Everton in the quarterfinal, we didn't win a game for the first 12 games of the season. Then Mal lost his job in November. John Bond came in and he just introduced three players, that was all. The rest of the squad was the same. He brought in Jerry Gow from Bristol City to add a little bit of steel into the middle of the park to play alongside Steve McKenzie, who was a little bit more artistic as a midfield player, with a nice range of passes. And then he bought two players from Coventry, Tommy Hutchison, who got Kevin Ratcliffe sent off, as he said. and then Bobby McDonald, who was a left-back and, a sort of more of a defender than I was. And he allowed me to move into the middle of the park. And I think that was maybe a reason that I scored a few goals that season as well, because I was further up the pitch. But, he only introduced those three players, but it transformed us. We actually lost the first two games that John Bond got there. I think we got beat 1-0 by Birmingham, and then we lost away from home. And then we won the next three games, and then the confidence starts to appear. You know, then we went on the FA Cup run, the confidence just mounted in the team. Young players who were frightened at the beginning of the season because the crowd were getting on top of them, all of a sudden were enjoying the adulation of the supporters, you know, and the nice feelings that successful results bring. So John Bond and John Saint and John Benson, the three Johns, we knew them as, were a good team. They were a team of management and coaches and assistant manager. And, you know, everybody seemed to change the atmosphere around. They enjoyed playing for them. They enjoyed being in the dressing room with us, you know. So, a lot of things changed. But I think the biggest single factor was a confidence one.
I'll ask you, Stephen, because I'm pretty sure I'm going to know your answer here, but Do you lament the loss of the big... There are characters still in the game. Don't get me wrong. I don't for a minute think the game is devoid of characters, certainly at managerial level. But when you look at the era, certainly that Paul played in, you know, slightly before and slightly after, and you look at some of those, you know, and Paul's mentioned there about, you know, it was a little bit all about Malcolm Allison. But in some respects, you know, great managers... And even now, some great managers will take the pressure off players by being almost the bigger story and the bigger personality. But do you lament the loss of the characters like Malcolm Allison in the game?
Yes, because I think a lot of people probably do, and that's why someone like Jose Mourinho, no matter how polarising he can be, attracts so much attention. It's why, you know, Jurgen Klopp is so popular. There's this magnetism. There's magnetism about Carlo Ancelotti, for instance. I think people, you know, still reach out for that. You know, I've always been a great believer that, you know, supporters of football clubs will almost morph into the personality of the manager that's managing the football club. You could perhaps suggest that Manchester United fans had a little bit of arrogance about them for the best part of a quarter of a century that's vanished in the last 7 or 8 years. So for me, yes, I think people do lament that. You know, going back to Manchester City at that point in time, you know, Malcolm Allison, yes, you know, totally get the concept of I was trying to turn the clock back and it not quite working and being stubborn. You know, for me, you know, he is my default setting Manchester City manager to an extent because he's the first one that I remember. So it's an oddity in that respect. Is that, I don't know, I always seem to hark back to, you know, a manager of a football club. I always kind of hark back to the first one I remember them and compare and contrast. So yes, Malcolm Allison was a huge, huge character. But then John Bond was as well. You know, you'll have to look at that documentary that Paul was mentioning. You know, John Bond was very straight talking from what he seemed to be. I can always remember him being like a pundit on a lot of football matches in the early 80s into the mid 80s. And I can remember one, I think, at the England Hungary game, for instance, and him really kind of like slagging Ray Clements off for his first half performance and how he should be yanked off at half time and stuff like that. You know, Brian Clough was the atypical kind of like character in this respect. And Paul mentioned like the programmes of Big Match Revisited and stuff like that. You know, there are some fascinating programmes to watch because of this, I don't know, a bluntness that isn't necessarily there now, certainly not from British coaches. I think when you get a foreign coach that comes over and you have that language barrier or certain language kind of like restrictions almost, is that you get a returnness of that a return of that bluntness, because it's a case of getting your points over the best way you can. And it's only later on when a manager's been around for like 4 or 5 years and language improves and suddenly they start to play the game in a more PR way. I always love the bluntness of managers and you know, Malcolm Allison and John Bond had that in abundance.
Sorry, Paul. I'll briefly say managers have to be comfortable in all sorts of environments. So they've got to be able to walk into the dressing room. And Howard Kendall was the best manager I played for, without a doubt. And that's not just because we won the league when he was manager. But he could come into the dressing room and he'd tell one of his crap jokes, which you know, he had loads of them. And but he wouldn't sidle off out of the dressing room. He'd take the abuse that the players had given for his poor joke, like, you know, and he'd be a part of that players' unit when we went on end of season tours and pre-season tours. He would drink more than the players, and you know, it'd be comfortable having a drink with the players and, you know, sharing moments and everything. He was also really good with the press. He knew how to handle the press. He was good in boardroom meetings because he knew how to speak to the boardroom with respect and sort of win them over with convincing arguments. Colin Harvey took over from Howard, and he wasn't quite the same. He wasn't comfortable with the press, and he wasn't comfortable with the boardroom either, but he was fantastic around the players and in the dressing room, which made him a superb coach. But a manager has to have all those, has to be a bit of a chameleon, really, and he's got to blend into all those different environments in the football club, you know, and it's not an easy job by any stretch of the imagination.
I was just about to ask Paul McPall that. I was just about to say there, you know, do you think that either the game has become more sanitised, Paul, or do you think that managers, as you know, as Paul's just explained there, managers are almost not protected, but certainly either because it's so demanding, there's so many roles to play that now clubs can employ, you know, you have the director of football at clubs now, and you know, there are so many different roles that almost take away that dominant managerial personality that was Clough, it was Shankly, it was Busby, it was Jock Steen, it was Revy. You know, those days are gone now. And either, you know, is it because the game has become a lot more sanitized and a lot more PR and a lot more correct, or is it because that there is so much, and I guess it comes back to what we were talking about before, this 24-hour saturation of the game. You know, is it because it is an impossible job for a manager to run all aspects of a football club now?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the modern era, it is almost an impossible job for a manager to have a handle on every aspect of what the role involves, particularly for the Premier League clubs. I think you just don't touch constant spotlights. And of course, you know, when Big Mal was at the height of his powers, he didn't have to deal with the pressure of social media, particularly. I can imagine how many Twitter stores Big Mal might have started in the 70s with being photographed coming off some nightclubs with the pay three girls 6-7 nights a week. I feel like Stephen touched on there before. I think I like the managers from the 70s for the big personalities that they brought to the game. And to some extent, you could argue their personalities were actually far bigger than their achievements. I mean, can you imagine a situation where Arsene Wenger decides to bring in a pace three girls to jump at the communal bath with the Arsenal players as a normal everyday routine thing, which Alisson did at Crystal Palace? I mean, absolutely unbelievable that, you know, that would be entertaining these days. And I think as well, the mod manager, they've got to be so much more careful about what they say, who they say it to, because, you know, there are more and more consequences these days. If you make a faux pas in a press conference, if you seem to be losing your temper, if you seem to have a fallout with a star player, suddenly you're on quite dodgy territory. So I think it is almost an impossible job these days. Having said that, it's incredibly well rewarded. I know there are lots of other possible jobs that aren't quite as well rewarded, but and I still think as well, many modern managers still, I think Stevens was upon this with Alex Ferguson, with Mike Nicer, and Klopp with Liverpool, and maybe Guardiola now with Man City, their image is imposed on the clubs, and you know, they will leave a legacy. And I always think it's really important that whoever the big man is at the top, they must leave a legacy at that club for the person who follows them to move into. I think Ferguson's, my criticism of Ferguson would be he didn't plan really his succession, who would take over from him, but he brought in an outsider. Maybe it would be better training somebody from within the club to do that, to move them on. It's another podcast, this one, Stu. I mean, the role of the modern manager compared to what it was like in the 70s, they have got so many more things to deal with. They've got more people to help them with. And you could argue that maybe gives them less control over things. I don't know. It's an interesting debate, that one.
And the introduction of social media as well is an absolute nightmare for. Yeah. I mean, some of the tours that I went on, you know, if there'd have been social media about at the time when Adrian Heath and Peter Reid and Graham Sharp and all that crowd, I mean, they really knew how to enjoy themselves, like, you know what I mean. But if there'd have been social media and people with cameras at the ready, there'd have been a lot more trouble, than there actually was in the day. Nowadays, players have got to be so careful. I mean, You had the situation with Phil Foden where he was caught sort of abusing his time with the England squad. You know, so you've got to be so much more careful these days than we had to.
It's right. Okay, we're going to have to come to the key moment, Paul, and that is first of all the semi final. What it's like to play an FA Cup semi final. What it's like to score in an FA Cup semi final. And then it's got to be, which for me is still the greatest FA Cup final. That replay on the Thursday night is still the, when anybody mentions the FA Cup, that to me is my go-to game and my go-to memory. Just take as long as you want to talk.
Well, I married a girl from Sale who had three brothers, were all Man United fans. Billy, her eldest brother, when we got through to the semi-final and we were drawn against Ipswich, he said, I'll tell you what, he said, if you get to the final, I'll wear all blue. I'll wear all blue at Wembley. And because he knew that, you know, we'd very little chance of beating Ipswich. Ipswich were the time of the team of the era. You know, they had, like Mick Mills was the captain, they had Beattie and Butcher and the two Dutch lads, Tyson and Muren. They had Walk, Mariner. They were a team of international players, really, and they were winning the league. They were doing well in Europe, and here they were in the semi-final of the FA Cup, and nobody fancied us at all. And in fact, if I'm perfectly honest, we probably didn't fancy ourselves that much, you know. But as the game went on, it came to the 90 minutes. It was 0-0, and oh God, what was his? I'm awful with names at the moment. Eric Gates was walking off with his boots under his arm, and I said, "I think you'll find that there's extra time." He went, "No, no, it's a replay, isn't it?" I said, "No, no, it's a 30 minutes extra time." He said, "Oh, you can have it then." So I thought, "Well, I hope your teammates are thinking exactly the same way." There was a long ball played through, and Dave Bennett, the black Dave Bennett that played for City as opposed to the white one who played for Norwich, he went through and he was sort of bustled off the ball by, I think it was Terry Butcher, it might. And they gave us a free kick. We practiced free kicks, so Steve McKenzie would touch the ball to me, and then if nobody, usually then somebody would come off the end of the wall and close the ball down to stop the shot. If nobody comes off the end of the wall, I would either shoot if I thought it was on to shoot, or if somebody came off the end of the wall to close the ball, I'd knock it again for Tommy Caton to come and strike it with his superb left foot, like, you know. They had a player on the end of the wall, which was Eric Gates. And when Steve McKenzie played it to me, nobody came. He didn't come off and close the ball down, like, you know. So I thought, Brian Kidd always had a saying that if you don't buy a raffle ticket, you don't win a prize, you know. So I thought, I'm going to buy a raffle ticket here. And and Paul Cooper, who was a goalkeeper, wasn't the biggest. You know, he was an agile shot-stopping goalkeeper, but he didn't fill the goal like Petr Cech and people like Joe Corrigan and that, you know. So I thought, he didn't look that big in the goal, so I thought, I'll have a strike. And, you know, fortunately, it was the 100th minute of the game, actually, of the 100th FA Cup final. I'll never forget. and then that set us up nicely then to go and play Spurs, who we did fancy ourselves against, you know. even though they had two foreign players in Ardiles and Villa, they had Glenn Hoddle, you know, but they weren't as good as Ipswich, and we thought that, you know, we might be able to overpower them. And to be fair, in the first game, we did overpower them. The Wembley pitch took its toll on their legs rather than on ours. We had good young athletes in the team like Tommy Caton, Nicky Reid, Ray Ranson. I could run all day. You know, and their players were falling and sort of kneeling on the ground and were struggling. If it had been played to a conclusion that first game, we'd have won that. There's absolutely no doubt, because we finished physically much stronger than them. But I think because of the result of, you know, having put so much effort into that game. Thanks, Chips. It took it out of us for the replay, and we played on the Thursday night, and I just think because we couldn't close the ball down, we didn't, you know, Jerry Gow and myself probably weren't at it the same as we were in the first game. And it allowed their more skillful players, like the Hoddles and the Ardiles, to express themselves more than they could do in the first game. So it was probably like a bridge too far for us a little bit. You know, even though we did go in the lead, I think Kevin Reeves scored just after half time and we went 2-1 up. And then, of course, there was the Ricky Villa goal, which I think looking back, our defenders should have dealt with him before he got in the box. Once he'd got into the box and he was a jinky type of forward, they were frightened to tackle him because, you know, they were always aware that they might give a penalty away. But so we should have dealt with him outside the box. As it turns out, we didn't. And the rest was history, of course, like, you know. But, it was a massive shame. But, you know, the chairman, Peter Swales, we had a dinner after the game, and, you know, he said, better to have been there and lost than not to have been there at all. The players didn't actually feel that on the night, but looking back at it, it's a great, great experience to be involved in an FA Cup final. It's the sort of thing, when I was a little lad growing up in Woodhouse Park, I used to dream about. My dad used to go to Woodhouse Park Labour Club and they'd have a coach trip to Wembley, and he went to watch Preston North End against Burnley in the FA Cup. And, you know, so I was brought up on that sort of aura, the aura of it. And it was always on the television and, you know, there'd be cameras on the coach and you'd see how the players were preparing for the game. And it was great to be involved in all of that. But just unfortunately, I didn't get my bloody hands on that trophy.
I'm gonna ask Stephen and Paul about their thoughts on the 81 Cup final. But just one thing that you've touched on there. I mean, I get it. I absolutely get what you've just said there. It's better to have been a part of it. But I suppose I often think back to Maradona's goal in 86 and what it, the sort of conflict almost of that second goal. And you know, I've seen interviews with Peter Reid and Gary Lineker and, you know, and John Barnes, and, you know, people talk about just almost being the sort of almost privilege of being on the same pitch at the same time when moments, and we've talked about moments, you know, and how important they are. But I guess every time the FA Cup comes around, and certainly the FA Cup final comes around, that goal must be shown thousands and thousands of times. And I guess, you know, what I'm asking is, you know, is it, I suppose you partly answered, but is it a privilege that you were there, you were on the pitch, you were a part of what is FA Cup folklore, or is it, oh my God, it's the FA Cup final, they're going to show that goal again?
Is that a question to me, sorry?
Yeah, it's, yeah. Listen, Austin didn't.
Listen, Steve McKenzie scored one of the best goals in the FA Cup final in that game.
Yeah.
A volley from the edge of the box. It was an unbelievable goal, but nobody ever remembers it because of the Ricky Villa goal, you know. So Steve McKenzie's really unfortunate because he had a moment that I had in the semi-final, but nobody bloody remembers his moment, like, you know what I mean, which is a shame because it was overshadowed by this tremendous dribble and finish. And I still fancied Joe Corrigan to save it, even though he got into the box and, you know, as composed as he was. But unfortunately, it didn't happen for us, you know.
Stephen, for you, the 81 FA Cup final replay?
Yeah, just a wonderful guy. I do remember Steve McKenzie's goal, and it is very much, for a long time, and maybe even still, is my favourite goal from that game, because that was the goal that just kind of like blew the game wide open. You know, Spurs had scored early, you know, and then you kind of feared the worst for City, because there's always that feeling that, you know, when a team has come close to winning, you know, if you've lost that chance, then they often get steamrolled in the replay. So when Steve McKenzie scores this wonderful goal, it just blew the game wide open, and for City to edge ahead as well at 2-1, suddenly it was properly game on. So yes, you know, it was just such a massive, and it was the first replay as well at Wembley. So it felt like a bonus. You know, you were getting two defined FA Cup finals in the space of 5 days. You know, and it was, it really was a wonderful game, and Man City played a huge part in that. You know, you do, and I've said it before about kind of like moments of glory, and it can be the same with a league title, you know, and a cup final can be exactly the same, as that, yes, you have a defined winner, only one team can win, but you do get occasions where, you know, whether it's a cup final or a league title being handed out, that there would have been, you know, had the cards fallen for the other team, then they'd have been a valid winner just the same. You know, it's like you know, I think 85, 86, the season before Paul joins Everton, Liverpool, Everton and West Ham. You know, Liverpool edged the title that season. But, you know, that Everton side was, you know, arguably better than the one that won the title the season before. It was the best West Ham side ever. So had Everton or West Ham won that league title, it wouldn't have made them, you know, an undeserved champion. You know, the season 80-81. That Ipswich side that lost the FA Cup semi-final didn't close out the league title. Fatigue saw them, you know, fall at the final stretch, and Villa came through. And sometimes that Villa side get a little bit of a poor rap for that, because they went out of the domestic cups early. They didn't play in Europe. You know, they played 20-odd games fewer. But, you know, that side was wonderful. Mortimer, you know, Tony Morley, you know, Gary Shaw, Peter Withe, you know, wonderful on the side that were worthy champions, deserved champions. And this 81 Cup final, had it gone City's way instead at 2-1, or, you know, Corrigan saves that chance and they edge the winner, they'd have been deserved winners. You know, the City were well worth over the two games there, you know, to have won that game, and it just wasn't to be.
Palmer Pound, for you, you know, obviously, you know, you're a passionate Everton fan. Stephen's a Liverpool fan, and I guess if your side is not playing in the FA Cup final, then A, you want, like Stephen said, A, you want two FA Cup finals, because there wasn't a lot of live football on the TV at that point anyway. So if you can get two, even better. But you certainly won, you know, I mean, there's, you know, Tommy Hutchinson with a brilliant header in the first game, and then the almost tragedy, almost Greek tragedy of the own goal that sends it to a replay. Then you have these five goals, you know, the lead changes hands three times, two brilliant goals. It's everything as a neutral or as a fan of football that you want your FA Cup final to be.
Yeah, I mean, I know recently, Stu, we talked about the Chelsea Leeds final, didn't we? The Ultimate Sweep in 1970. And, you know, I think I see a lot of similarities between those two games, apart from the constant fouling in the Chelsea Leeds game. But it's the fact it went to a replay, which, as Steve said, was really unusual, really rare. And because these two games were such close proximity, because there was quite a gap between the Chelsea Leeds first game and the second game, it added a bit more intensity to us. And like you just said there, Stu, I think you look at that equaliser goal from Tottenham in the first final, and City was just so unlucky. I mean, I still don't quite know what Tom Hutchinson was trying to do, whether he was trying to head it clear, shoulder it clear, or whatever, but it just left Corrigan with absolutely no chance whatsoever. And as Paul outlined there, and Steve said as well, that Steve McKenzie goal in the replay is absolutely superb. Is it? The cushion header from Hutchinson to set him up, the power, direction, pace of the shot, that the Leeds Clemens diving across thin air, it's just a brilliant goal. And I think, I suppose from Paul's point of view, I mean, you know, City were 2-1 up in the replay. You'd like to think you can see that situation now, you know, because, you know, Stephen often mentioned sliding doors moments. City going to win the FA Cup, they go to the Cup Winners' Cup that season. Maybe they're going to win the Cup Winners' Cup that season. Suddenly the direction of the club goes a different way. Instead, 2 years after the FA Cup final, City relegated. So the impact of losing that FA Cup had a massive, massive effect on City's future. Win the FA Cup, the future starts off a lot brighter. I think City, you know, overspent in the seasons after the FA Cup. The success didn't come. If they'd won that FA Cup, if they had a European run, if they'd beaten Stevens Cup in his cup boot, then you never quite know where the club would have gone in the future.
Can I just fill in a little bit of detail about, you know, you just said you don't know what Tommy Hutch was doing coming off the end of the ball. Well, neither did we. But we'd actually, we were aware that Glenn Hoddle was a danger from free kicks at the edge of the box. Joe Corrigan had said, because we'd set up a wall and we'd practiced the situation because we knew it was likely to happen. And Tommy Hutch said, well, what if I just come off the end of the wall and drop off the end of the wall? And then if he bends it in and it hits the post or the bar, I'll be first to the ball, like, you know. So Joe said, no, don't. He said, Lee, keep the wall solid and strong. And he said, if he can get the ball over the wall and down and in the other side of the goal that I'm not protecting, full marks to him. But that's the most difficult skill. So if he can do that, good luck to him. He deserves to beat me. On the day, so we all agreed that that's what had happened. On the day, Tommy just decided to take, you know, that he thought his idea was better. And and he dropped off the end of the wall. Of course, it deflected off him. Joe had gone to cover the one that was going over the wall, and Tommy deflected it into the other corner, which Joe was standing in the first place. But if you look at Tommy Hutch's reaction after that, you know, after the ball went in the net, he just goes down on his knee and he thinks, oh, what have I done? Like, you know, Joe doesn't give him a roasting, which is unusual for Joe because he's pretty good at that. And but he's, you know, it was just one of those moments that you practice against, but on the, you know, in the heat of the moment, everything goes wrong. Anyway, listen, I've got I'll finish my story about Julie's brother Billy.
Okay. Yeah.
Because he said he'd wear all blue if we went to Wembley. And these are the two incidents that I remember about the FA Cup final. Is I knew where all the family that I'd got tickets for, I knew where they were all going to be in the stadium. So, you know, when you come out on the pitch with your nice new Wembley suit on and everything, and I'm looking up in the stand, and there was Billy. He had a blue hat on, blue shirt, trousers, jumper, a big blue and white flag he was waving, like, you know, and I thought, you'll do for me. I didn't think. Anyway, he put his foot up on the hoardings, and he had red socks on, and he said, I couldn't do it. But also they used to run a competition for the best banner at the FA Cup final, you know, the best supporters banner. And the one that won it that year was City have the power to arrest crooks. If you remember Garth Crooks played for Tottenham. Yeah. And that banner won it, like, you know, and I would have loved to have got that banner from whoever had sort of invented the slogan. And it would have been in my bloody bedroom for the rest of my life. You know. We did arrest Crooks, but unfortunately we didn't arrest Villa. You know, so,
I feel like we've talked about a lot of sort of tragedy almost, and it does end well though, so it's okay. It does end well at Everton. But I'm just reading, halfway through reading Ricky Hill's book at the moment, and you started, and Paul mentioned earlier that game against Luton and then the relegation and, you know, those sliding door moments. And I guess I feel like I've asked you the same question so many times tonight, but that's because it's what I'm interested in and why I'm here. But what was that like?
Well, you see, I'm getting to dislike you now because you keep
I promise I've got I will ask you some lovely questions.
You keep asking me about moments in career, in my career, that where I wanted to commit suicide. You know, losing at Wembley, having been 2-1 up, and then you know, losing and watching David Pleat dance across the pitch, like, you know,
yeah.
And Brian Houghton, who later became a manager in Manchester City as well, but. We'd been down to the south coast, and we were in dire straits, but we managed to beat, I think it might have been Brighton or Portsmouth, it might have been. But anyway, we won away from home, which meant that we only had to draw against Luton at Main Road on the last game of the season. You know, we'd have stayed up and stayed in the first division. As it was, we got relegated and spent 2 years in the old second division before we got promoted under Billy McNeil. But that was the most depressing day of my life, really. And Julie will be pleased it wasn't my wedding day, but there you go. And And I remember coming off the pitch and the crowd sort of, sort of spilled onto the pitch. But before the game, one of our players, and I won't say who it was because it wouldn't be fair, had had a problem at home relating to his wife, like, you know, and he might as well not have been on the pitch that day, you know, because things are more important than football. And I certainly realised that. And when you become a family man, you know, a football match is important, but not, like Bill Shankly says, you know, there are more important things in life. And this particular, we had very little going forward. We'd struggled to contain them, and they had some good players in there, like David Moss was a good winger, and but we struggled a little bit to break through their defence. And I'm convinced to this day it was down to the fact that, you know, we had players that knew the situation about this individual, and we just weren't firing on all cylinders, like, you know. But yeah, that was a particularly bad moment too, because you never feel that, you know, a club as big as Manchester City. There were 52,000 at the Everton replay game, you know. So I'm sure, I don't know what the crowd was against Luton, but it would have probably been close to, it would have been full house, like, you know what I mean. And it was just a horrendous experience at the end, you know, looking round at all the players, the supporters were dejected. Some were angry, you know. So yeah, it was a bad day in my football life. That
I am really sorry. I am really sorry. But and it, I guess, Stephen, again, you know, and this is why this podcast was always going to be so good. But I kind of blame David Pleat, I guess, then, really. it's another one of those iconic moments that timestamps certainly our childhood, you know, in football, and, you know, being a part of it. You know, if we're interviewing Ricky Hill, for example, I'm sure it's going to, you know, be a completely different experience.
Different spin on it, yeah.
Yeah, but you so rarely get the opportunity to speak to people who were at the moments that in your life just almost seem mythical moments on the television, but they're so important to you. But to actually hear what it's like, and certainly from the sort of converse perspective of the tragedy that it was, you know, for 11 players and the fans and everybody else, because it's all about David Pleat, it's all about that beige suit, it's all about hoping he's going to fall over. But it's, you know, you also want to know what it was like tragically. You want to know what it was like to be on the receiving end of that. How did it feel to see him running across the pitch? You know, it must have been horrendous.
Yeah. Well, the dressing room afterwards was the quietest I've ever been in a dressing room. Nobody said anything. The manager didn't say anything. No players, you know, they were... It would have been so easy to criticise individuals. I mean, me in particular, I should have stopped the cross that resulted and led to the goal, like, you know. But I didn't stop the cross as a fullback. The winger got the cross in, and then, you know, it ended up in the back of the net. But that was on the Saturday. On the Sunday, we went on an end of season tour to Florida, and you know, we were. All the Sunday papers, you can imagine the Sunday People, the News of the World, it was all about Manchester City getting. So it wasn't just that game, you know. We had to live the whole blinking weekend. Luckily, we got away to Florida, where nobody bloody bothers about football anyway. Like, you know, so we were able to sort of relax a little bit more, and then we ended up winning that tournament, which really rubbed salt into the wounds, like, you know. But yeah, it was the most depressing I have ever been in a dressing room ever, and I've been in a few of those.
We will get to a really good dressing room in a few minutes. Don't worry about that. We'll get to a great dressing room.
Okay.
But yeah, Stephen, you know, like I say, these are just moments, aren't they? Like the FA Cup final, these are just iconic moments for a whole host of different reasons.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's, I think, was it the season? It was 12 months earlier, Leeds had gone down, which was huge, you know, and then suddenly City to go down. And it just made it seem very, very stark. You know, even as a Liverpool supporter, young kid, know, I knew the, you know, the significance of these football clubs and how important they were. And, you know, I'd watched Manchester City 2 years earlier in that FA Cup final, and that made it all the more stunning. You know, in the context of Leeds, you know, you could at least point that it had been, what, 8 years since they'd won anything. You know, with Man City, yes, they didn't win that FA Cup final, but they'd threatened to do so. They looked like a club on the up, you know, and it was quite, I mean, in a historical sense, it's quite fascinating. We do this series called End of an Era, in how teams unravel and empires come to an end, or teams that are in a promising position fumble the opportunity, and this is one of these prime kind of topics, really. You know, it was when it happens, there's almost kind of like a Zapruder effect to them. You know, no matter, even now, you could watch the footage and think Antic is going to send that shot into the crowd, or you know, and it always plays out the same way, but you still think just there's an off chance that, you know, this time I'll watch it and it'll turn out differently. Yeah, it was absolutely stunning.
Maybe if I keep watching it,
he might well spoon it into the crowd.
like I said, you know, to you, Paul Mack, you know, these, I guess it's how, and I'm obviously we'll ask Paul this in a second, you know, with the move to Everton, but it's how players, clubs, managers, how they recover from these moments, you know, how you build on success, I assume and guess, although I've never been a professional footballer, that's almost the easy part to build on momentum. It's how you recover from devastation as a player, or as a club, you know, staying or dropping down the leagues, and you know, and that's happened with clubs that we could all mention. But it's that as well. You know, these moments aren't just, as Paul mentioned there, it's not just David Pleat running on a pitch and then it's Saturday tea time, good night's sleep, Sunday morning, and you go again. These things have massive, prolonged, almost permanent, I guess, for some people and some players, permanent implications.
Yeah, I think for the fans as well. I think it takes the fans an awful long time to get over something like that. Same as Stephen, really. I mean, I've never experienced my team being relegated, so I can't sympathise with what this experience must be like. It's thankful I've never been through it, but it must be absolutely awful for me. I've got a really good friend who lives in Belfast, Gary Thompson, who came over to study in Manchester because he's a massive Man City fan, and I know he was absolutely devastated, you know, with the relegation that season.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably the City relegation, what was unusual about it was, as Stephen points out, it came from nowhere, because two seasons beforehand, they were in the FA Cup final. I think the season before they got relegated, Trevor Francis was in the forward line. On paper, City had a really, really good team. So their decline, you know, was quite unexpected. Because I think the season they went down, when they sacked John Bond, correct me if you're on here, Paul, City were 11th in the table after 25 games and didn't appear to be in any immediate danger. But then the form just fell off a cliff and then they went down. And, you know, you know, if I'd been a Luton fan, I'd been embarrassed by the manager's stance. I really would be. I wouldn't even be talking about having stayed up. And of course, you know, being from the north, you like the big games against the big teams. You know, I'd much rather watch Everton play Man City than Everton play Luton Town. And the way it kind of went, I mean, Luton became one of the most despised and hated clubs in the English Football League in the mid 80s anyway, with the no away fans policy. So I mean, certainly, you know, I'd much rather City had stayed up rather than losing, and because you missed the Manchester Liverpool clashes as well. But yeah, I mean, I think maybe the financial impact wasn't as great in the 80s as what it would be now, but I'm sure the financial impact on City must have been massive. I know Billy McNeil, when he arrived, was quite stunned by the lack of funds the City had to organise a charge back to the top division. And even the promotion call was on the last day of the season, wasn't it? City had to win at home and hope the Poles didn't win, or you were level on goal difference or something. So even that was quite a titanic struggle to get back again.
Yeah. Well, we actually missed out on promotion the first season. I think Sheffield Wednesday definitely went up. I think Chelsea were in that division with us as well. So those were the two teams that got promoted. We finished third that year. And I think that's right. Anyway, I'm not far sure. And then the following year, of course, we still didn't win the league. You know, when Billy McNeil was in charge. But you see, there was John Bond, John Benson, and John Saintie. They were a team, and the players had respect for them as a unit. You know, Then Billy McNeil came. He was a totally different kettle of fish. He was a typical Scottish manager. You know, you just mentioned the manager of Celtic, who would have been his manager when he was playing. Jock Stein, yeah. Tommy Docherty. That, you know, real domineering. His nickname was Caesar, Billy McNeil. Yeah. Because his chest was right out here, and he was never wrong. And you know, but a totally different type of manager. But the type of manager that we needed at that particular time, because I think some of the players thought, they were a little bit too big for this second division. You know, and Billy McNeil, brought the feet right down to earth, you know, made everybody realise how important this job was, to get back in the first division as quickly as possible, and in the end, it sort of paid dividends, although he wasn't particularly well liked in the dressing room, Billy McNeil, you know, but he was one of these Brian Clough type, who was on his own. His assistant was Jimmy Frizzell, but I think, you know, Frizz was sort of thrust upon him a little bit. He came down on his own from Scotland. He didn't come as a unit, you know. It was difficult for the players to relate to him, but he was the right man for the job to get us promotion from there. Unfortunately, he sold me.
Fortunately, he sold me
to Everton, where I started to have some smiles in my life.
And this is it. You see, it was always going to be a story that ends well. Granted, it's taken us nearly 2 hours. By the by, it just makes it all the more worthwhile. So, you know, we do finally get to some joy and to some success. First of all, did the sale come as a surprise? Was it something that was in the air that you thought could happen, or was it a complete shock, bolt from the blue?
It was a complete shock, because I'd just signed a one-year extension of my contract at City. I was 32 then, and to be fair, you know, it was good business on City's part, because if I'd have served my one-year extension, that would have put me at 33. And any in those days, if a player had been at a club for longer than 10 years, on his 33rd birthday, he was entitled to a free transfer, you know. So they also had, City also had Andy Hinchcliffe, who was a young England international prospect coming through the U team and reserves. So it was good business on their part. But I was actually away on holiday. I was at a hotel in Devon called the Salt and Sands Hotel, and we had a young family. This was 1986, and I got a phone call from Jimmy Frizzell. Billy McNeil was away. I think 1986 was a Mexico, South America Olympic. World Cup. Scotland were in it, and Billy McNeil was doing some sort of commentary for the Scottish team. So Jimmy Frizzell said, we've had an offer from Howard Kendall. He wants to sign you for Everton. The club have decided they'll let you go. What do you think? So I thought to myself straight away, well, if the club are phoning me up on holiday, they're obviously made their mind up that, you know, I maybe don't feature in what Manchester City's future is going to be. I'd spoken to Billy McNeil earlier in that season, and he said to me, I went to a game last night. He said, it's the best team performance I've ever seen from any team. And of course, he played for the European Cup winning team like Caesar, you know what I mean? So he had played for a team. And he said that he watched Everton beat Man United 5-0, I think. I can't remember whether it was at Old Trafford or Goodison. Paul will remember it.
Yeah, it was 5-0 at Goodison, Paul. Yeah.
So, I was there. So he said he'd just seen the best team performance he'd ever seen from any team, like, you know. And then all of a sudden, at the end of that season, I'm getting a phone call to go and join them, like, you know. Well, I knew they had a problem with Pat Van Den Hau, who was injured. So I thought maybe they were looking for a bit of experience cover there. And then as soon as Pat got fit, you know, then I'd probably be back in the reserves or whatever. But I thought, well, I'm in with a shout, so I'll go and speak to him. So I told Jimmy Frizzell I'd speak to him, but I wasn't going to cut my holiday short, like, you know. it wasn't that important to sign for Everton. So I'm only joking. But I so on the Friday afternoon, I arranged to go to Belfield and meet Howard. And he said, "What would stop you signing for Everton today?" Like, you know. So I said, "Well, two things really." I said, bearing in mind this was about June the 27th, on July the 1st, I was entitled to a loyalty bonus from Manchester City because I'd been there sort of 13 years. I got a loyalty payment, which is a significant amount of money to me at the time, although probably not to Phil Foden at the moment. But anyway. So I've got this, you know, this payment to come. And he said, anything else? So, because it was due on July the 1st. And I said, well, I won't, if I do sign for you, it won't be until after July the 1st. So Howard said, well, no, I want you to sign before you leave this room this afternoon, like, you know. So he said, anything else? So I said, well, I've been due a testimonial at Manchester City as well. It's been cancelled twice, a game against Man United. Once for the Bradford fire was the police wouldn't police it. And then the other occasion was when a Leeds United fan, I think, was killed at Birmingham, or a Birmingham fan was killed at Leeds. And so the police wouldn't police the game at the end of that season either. So it was cancelled twice. And so he said, right, I'll tell you what we'll do. Everton who play Man City in your testimonial game, you can play half for Everton and half for City. So I thought, okay. You know, he was impressing me by this point, you know. Then he phoned Billy McNeil, who was in South America. And Billy McNeil didn't know that I was in the room, I don't think. And he said, Paul's due a loyalty payment for you, but I want him to sign before... I'm sure there won't be any problem with him getting his loyalty, you know, for being loyal to Manchester City for 13 years. You know, Billy McNeil said, I don't think our chairman will give it him unless he's there on, you know, the end of the contract on July the 1st. So Howard said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Everton will pay Paul Power his loyalty payment for being loyal to Manchester City for 13 years and put the phone down. Like, straight away, I'm thinking, I like this fella, you know. He obviously wants to sign me. So I went for a medical, and doctor, tell me the name of the doctor that would have been there. A bald fella.
I'm not sure, Paul.
Jewish. Oh my God. Anyway, Ian. Anyway, he took me off for a medical, and he said, do you drink? And I said, I like a social drink, you know. He said, well, you better learn to drink if you join this club, you know. So straight away, I'm thinking, you know, there's obviously a good atmosphere in the dressing room. The players all got on well together. I didn't realise quite how good drinkers they were, by the way, until I signed. But people like, you know, Adrian Heath and Sharpie and, you know, like they all knew how to enjoy themselves. So that was it. I signed for Everton then, and you know, I made my debut for Everton in the Community Shield, as it was then, like, you know, against Liverpool. And they signed Neil Adams from Stoke at the same time. They signed Dave Watson from Norwich, and the team was full of captains, really. You know, I mean, Kevin Ratcliffe was the captain, but Peter Reid could have been quite easily. I'd been captain at Manchester City for about 8 years. Dave Watson had been captain at Norwich for a number of years. So, you know, there was a lot of maturity in the dressing room, but a lot of good, strong characters as well, like, you know, Paul Bracewell. Even players that weren't guaranteed a place would have walked into Man City's team, Alan Harper and... the lad that went to Aston Villa, Kevin Richardson. Yeah. They, you know, they sat on the bench a lot of the time when, you know, they'd have got into most teams quite comfortably. So we had a strong squad as well. Great players like Gary Stevens and Trevor Stephen on the right side. I mean, my job as fullback was a doddle because I had Kevin Sheedy in front of me, who always came and wanted the ball at his feet. And I knew that I could give it to him and he would deal with it. You know, if I fired it in at him, his touch was so good that he would deal with it. And if I couldn't give it to him, I'd drop it into Sharpie and he would hold it up. And you know what I mean? So everything was geared to making my job easy. Pat Van Den Hau was injured for a lot longer than they thought he would be. He didn't come back till January. Just before Christmas.
It was January, Paul. He came back in January, yeah.
But it was when City played, it was when Everton played City at Main Road, and I actually scored against Man City, and people criticised me for not celebrating the goal, you know. But I still had players on the pitch that were playing for Man City, like Neil McNabb and Kenny Clements, Mick McCarthy, who were my mates, and I didn't feel that I should dance around flailing my arms, even though another goalkeeper, Perry Suckling, you know, made a right hash of the shot. So I got two moments in my life, and I think they were down to poor goalkeepers. Well, there you go. But yeah, I mean, that, and then I played the whole of that season. In fact, I had problems with my knee. And I'd had a couple of cortisone injections in my knee, which probably wouldn't happen these days, but it saw me through the season. And then the last two games of the season, we actually won promotion at Norwich, away at Norwich. And what a great journey home that was, by the way. It's about 7 hours from Norwich. Teams will probably fly home now in about half an hour, but we were 7 hours on this bus. Terry Darricott was on the mic at the front of the bus, made everybody get up and sing a song. Even Pat Van Den Hau was not that sort of character at all. Like, you know, he went up and gave a rendition of Boiled Beef and Carrots or something. But, you know, it was a fantastic journey home. And, you know, and then the last two games of the season, I didn't play because I went in to get my knee sorted. So it gave me a little bit longer to recover in the close season for the next season. But, it was unbelievable. Great moments, those. Good people as well, Colin Harvey, Howard Kendall, Mick Lyons. You know, I mean, when I scored that goal against Everton in the quarterfinal, Mick Lyons was the centre-half. And I've got a photograph. I've got a photograph just outside this door now of that goal, me scoring the goal. And Mick Lyons is like desolate, you know, much the same as I was against Luton. Well, he was the same when he saw this ball loop over the goalkeeper's head. Tell me, who was the goalkeeper? He was Irish, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was Jim Acker, Seamus McDonough.
Seamus, yeah. So that was a, you know, I sort of used to take that photograph in to wind Lionsey up, because this was a this was a few years later. The quarterfinal was in 1981, and then of course I joined Everton in 1986-87 season, like, so it was a few years later. I think Lionsey probably played in more semi-finals and never got to a Wembley final. You know, he was a real unlucky player in that respect, but a great bloke, really great bloke. And all the staff at Everton at the time were fantastic.
I guess, Paul Mack, this is exactly the sort of thing that you love to hear, love to listen to, sort of reinforces, I guess, your connection with the club as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I've always been a firm believer that the 86-87 team never quite got the credit it deserved. It kind of suffers in comparison with the 84-85 team. And, I mean, that league title win 86-87, Everton won by 9 points. They were the top scorers in the first division. They conceded less goals than anybody else in the first division. And for the first half of the season, the whole side was wrecked with injury. PCB missed half the season. Gary Stevens missed a third of the season. Van der Hau missed half the season. Paul Bracewell missed the whole season. Kevin Sheedy missed most of the second half of the season. Graham Sharp missed most of the second half of the season. So somehow, this one, like support power, turned out to be such an astute sign about Harry Kane, because first off, he settled in at left back. And yeah, I think Paul would accept this. His signing didn't quite excite Everton fans at first, because we didn't quite see why we need to bring Paul Power in. But as we watched him game on game, and he was the fittest player on the pitch. I remember Alan Harper saying to me, he was like Peter Pan in training. He was so fast down the touchline, but no one could keep up with him, and no one understood where he was getting his energy from. And when you watch those games from 86, 87, particularly when Paul was playing in midfield, the number of times he burst down the left-hand side, leaves defenders 10 years younger than him, trailing in his wake. And then the quality of the cross, which would unerringly pick out either Adrian Heath or Wayne Clark or Graham Sharp in the penalty area. I mean, how many assists you got that season, Paul? I'm not quite sure. But I know it was your It was your second highest goal scoring career, wasn't it, after 80-81? You got 4 goals ever since that season. And I think, you know, the difference Paul made to the sides was tremendous. And by the end of the season, it was a joint tie, wasn't it, between you and Kevin Ratcliffe for the play of the season?
Yeah, yes, it was, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. But for someone who'd only been with the club since the start of the season, to get to that level, and, Paul just became a firm favourite with the fans. And in terms of commitments, in terms of professionalism, in terms of not letting the side down, in terms of playing whatever the manager asks, and then also playing through an injury until we won the championship at Norwich. You know, that is why, for people of my generation, Paul Power is up there in terms of Everton legends.
It's funny, because when I joined the club, Adrian, he said to me, listen, all you've got to do to get the crowd on you, because I was a little bit worried, being a Manc and coming into a Scouse environment. And I know that Phil Neville had problems, winning over the crowd when he came over from Man U. But I thought maybe Man United was different than Man City. It was there was a much greater rivalry there. But still being a Manc, and Adrian E said to me, listen, just win the crowd over here. Just slide right into players. If you miss the tackle, slide off onto the shale and they'll love you. The crowd will love you for that. And it was just a little bit of advice that stuck with me. And because we were winning games, the crowd sort of took to me pretty well, really. I was lucky, but we played a game. Well, two games I remember. We played Man United at Goodison Park. We beat them 3-1, and I went down the left and I put a cross in. And Graham Sharp scored a header. It must have been just on the edge of the 18-yard box. It was an unbelievable header. And I got loads of credit for getting the crossing. Nobody else would have scored that goal. Except Sharpie, And of course, with it being against United as well, I maybe over-celebrated a little bit. But the best team performance that I've ever played in, whether Billy McNeil had seen Everton beat Man United 5-0, I'm not bothered. But we played against Newcastle at St James's Park, and it was Boxing Day, I think. It was over the Christmas period anyway. And it was the best. We absolutely battered them. I think it might have been 4-0, yeah. But
it's 4-0.
Oh my God. Are you the historian? but Trevor Stephen was unbelievable on that day. He was absolutely outstanding. And I just, that was the best team performance I've ever been involved in, and that set us up nicely for the end of the year. But we got beat in the FA Cup that year. I think it was Watford.
It was Wimbledon, Paul.
Oh, Wimbledon, right? Yeah, okay, yeah. I stand corrected. But most managers would have, because we were expected to beat Wimbledon, most managers would have had us in the morning training and run the proverbials off us. Howard said, everybody report to Southport to Mr. Lau's. It's a Chinese restaurant called Mr. Lau's in Southport. He said, everybody report there Monday lunchtime, 12 o'clock. If you're not there, it'll cost you a week's wages, And that was his way of improving team spirit. It wasn't let's run, let's get out on the pitch and work through where we went wrong. He believed in the players. We just had a day off, a bad day at the office, really. And we went to Mr. Lau's, and then we'd have lots of drinking games like fizzbuzz and everything, everybody got drunk. And at the end of the night, he was renowned, Howard, for getting his favourite players around the fireplace and sharing a bottle of champagne. So it was always Inchy and Sharpie and Reedy. They were all... So Dave Watson, who was new to the club as I was, he said, and he was sitting next to Howard. So Howard, we're all sitting at the dinner table, and we'd finished the meal, and Howard had this bottle of champagne between his feet, which was for his favourite players round the fireplace afterwards, you see. So anyway, he had to go to the loo. So he said to Dave Watson, will you look after this for me? So he put this bottle of champagne between Dave Watson's feet and he went off to the toilet. Dave Watson opened it, gave everybody a drink of this champagne that was at the table. Howard wasn't there. He came back, Howard, and Dave passed it him under the table, put it between his feet again. He didn't know it was empty. Like, so he came to share his bottle with the best players at the end of the day. Of course, he had an empty bottle of champagne, but he could take that. A lot of managers, you know, wouldn't be able to take that as a joke, but there was a great team spirit and a togetherness. Like it was a wonderful, wonderful season for me. Without a doubt.
I mean, like I say, I'm glad it's ended well because it would have been horrendous if it finished with the Lou again.
I'd have been finding out where you live.
But you know, Stephen, I guess you know Liverpool fan. You know, we've talked about sort of the mid '80s and the rise of Everton and stuff. But I think as well, one of the points that comes there is transfer dealings, and it's not always about signing the best players. It's about signing the right players. You know, and clearly Paul's transfer from Manchester City at the age he was, you know, and sort of Paul's mentioned it probably wasn't the most exciting signing for Everton fans. But it's not always the most exciting signings that are the most effective signings. And I think that still holds true today as it did 30 years ago, as it maybe did 50 years ago.
Yeah, I think both Liverpool and Everton at that point in time had a knack of signing the right player. They had an eye for the right player. Other teams would go for, you know, the big splash signing. You know, we always used to kind of like mock them for kind of like going for the final piece of the jigsaw. You know, and they would break kind of like the British transfer record to do it, and it would always be a signing that was going to make the difference. This was going to win them the title, or you know, this was going to make to bridge the gap or whatever it was. And both Liverpool and Everton had this knack of saying, well, no, we go for the right player, and that was as much the personality of the player and the, you know, the mental strength of a player as it was the ability with the ball, and Paul fitted that perfectly for Everton that season. Ian Snowden was another one that came in made a big difference. You know, I look back at that Everton side and, you know, a great deal of respect for it, even though there were our, you know, close rivals. It was a wonderful era to watch football on Merseyside. You know, the title went back and forth for 4 years between Anfield and Goodison. And it was a healthy rivalry. Trevor Stephen was a player that I absolutely admired massively. Paul Bracewell was another. So, you know, we had this admiration for the players. And Paul Power came in and we looked askance about it a little bit. But then as we watched him play and you know, totally admired him as a City player. And then, yes, you know, he was made such a difference to that Everton side throughout. And yes, you know, they were fully deserving of the title that year. You know, we started quite well, but we faded from about the February, I think it was. The loss of Jim Beglin was a big blow, as was an Achilles injury to Mark Lawrenson. I think we went to the League Cup final without a left back. I think Ronnie Whelan played left back against Arsenal in the League Cup final, stuff like that. Rush was going. So there was a great deal of churn in the Liverpool side. But Everton came on strong, massively strong. And as Paul said, Paul McPalmer said about the injuries that Everton sustained, to be able to do that and, you know, absorb all those injury problems and not just do that as well, but to have lost Gary Lineker as well that summer and not really replaced him. You know, Wayne Clark, yes, but, you know, Paul Wilkinson was knocking around. But it wasn't like when, you know, they exchanged Andy Gray for, you know, and brought in Gary Lineker. You know, they got a huge amount of money for Gary Lineker and you were expecting them to make a big splash signing to replace him. They didn't, you know, and Kendall put his trust in the players that he already had, but then made these you know, what were deemed minor recruitments. And it just paid massive dividends, and Paul was a huge part of that.
How long did it take the Everton fans then, Paul, before they were to be excited by the signing of Paul Power?
I think about 10 minutes. No, it was actually the Charity Shield, because we played at Wembley and we, you know, we I think we drew with Liverpool, didn't we? You'll tell me.
Yeah. It was 1-1, wasn't it? I mean, Asian people, Everton had, and Rush equalised, what, 2 minutes to go, I think, Stephen, to level the game, 1-1.
It was, yeah.
Rush always scored against Kevin Radcliffe. They both played for Wales, but he always scored against matters like, you know. It's, but anyway, chaps, I'm going to...
Yeah,
it keeps coming up battery low. And then I'll lose you on my screen, so absolutely delightful to talk to you, but... Here in France now, it's 20 to 12.
I am really
My wife's
sorry.
Been waiting outside the bedroom door to get
like I said, Paul, it's just been wonderful. It has just been everything that I hoped it would be and more. It's been
I've enjoyed it more than you.
Brilliant. So when you come back for part two, that'll be all right, won't it? Paul, enjoyed it?
Absolutely loved every second of it. I mean, the stuff we've covered here from the schoolboy football, the academies, the rise of Phil Foden, Sissy, Bond, Alisson, Billy McNeil, FA Cup finals, and then the glory of Everton 86, 87. What's not to like?
Stephen?
Well, I'll come back next time and we'll talk about Gordon Taylor and my time at the PFA. He is a top man, by the way.
Oh, excellent stuff. No, it's been absolutely brilliant, and we are definitely getting Paul Power as our first panini.
Nailed on. Absolutely nailed on, the first panini sticker guest we've had.
Yes.
Paul, you'll swap 10 of mine for one of Ian Rush. Is that
right? I wouldn't. That's what 10 of Ian Rush for, are you?
Paul, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, you've been brilliant.
For your time, but
thanks, Paul.
Brilliant. I've loved it, and all that's left for me to say is please join us again. There's no way it'll be as good as this, but please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with these football times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.